رحلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom and Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This show was created by late Sharif Fahm and continues in his memory by a group of his colleagues. My name is Salma Abu Ayyash, and I'm your host today, Sunday, May 29th, 2011. There has been some good news these past few days. For example, the University of London Union, the largest student union in Europe, voted to join the Boycott Israel campaign. Also, the National Union of Students, the NUS, which is the umbrella for all student unions in the UK, around 600 institutions, voted to end the occupation and the right of return. And some news, how should we say it? Well, I felt like I was in the twilight zone listening to Netanyahu's address to Congress recently. Not only the content, but also the context, where he was, how he delivered his address, and what it says about the state of affairs of this country when it comes to Israel. In an article on Friday, Franklin Lamb wrote, "Millions of American voters were offended this week by the vulgar display on Capitol Hill, which witnessed the annual rite of nearly two-thirds of members on Congress stumbling over one another at the annual AIPAC conference in order to ingratiate themselves with their hosts and to protect their sinecures. Equally nauseating to many was what some on Capitol Hill are calling the Congressional Black Tuesday, quote-unquote, when they assert Congress cheapened its status in American and foreign eyes and fouled itself by taking the role of undignified cheerleaders for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu during his appearance before a joint session of Congress, an invitation which normally is reserved for August occasions and accomplished personages. With 41 applause interruptions and 29 standing ovations, even with some appearing half-hearted and somewhat forced, Congress sent a message that the legislative branch is increasingly is under the control of a foreign power and not the executive branch, and it will continue to determine American policy toward Israel and the Middle East. This foreign power, in other words, will continue to determine American policy towards Israel and the Middle East. Some congressional scholars, historians, and longtime observers of Congress are expressing dismay over what seems to have dramatically diminished the claimed, quote-unquote, world's greatest deliberative body. Is this all the power of AIPAC? A friend last night said that Netanyahu's speech was a gift to Mersheimer and Walt, confirming their thesis about Israel's practical sovereignty over our governing bodies. Today we will be talking with Dr. Leila Farsakh on her reactions to the latest Obama and Netanyahu speeches on the Arab-Israeli situation. Leila Farsakh is Associate Professor in Political Science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. She is the author of Palestinian Labor, Migration to Israel, Labor, Land, and Occupation, an editor of Commemorating the Naksa, Evoking the Nakba, which is an electronic journal of Middle Eastern studies. She has also published on questions relating to Palestinian labor flows, the Oslo process, and international migration in a wide range of journals, including the Middle East Journal, the European Journal of Development Research, Journal of Palestine Studies, and Le Monde Diplomatique. In 2001, she won the Peace and Justice Award from the Cambridge Peace Commission in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to This Week in Palestine, Leila, and good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's listen. We'd like to start, Leila, by listening to a short clip with some selections of Netanyahu's statements made on Tuesday, May 24th. So let's hang on a minute before we get some of your reactions. He was addressing U.S. Congress on Capitol Hill.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and the distinct honor of presenting to you His Excellency Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel.
Peace can only be achieved around the negotiating table. I'm willing to make painful compromises to achieve this historic peace. The border will be different than the one that existed on June 4th, 1967. Israel will not return to the indefensible boundaries of 1967. In Judea and Samaria, the Jewish people are not foreign occupiers. The vast majority of the 650,000 Israelis who live beyond the 1967 lines reside in neighborhoods and suburbs of Jerusalem and Greater Tel Aviv. And under any realistic peace agreement, these areas, as well as other places of critical strategic and national importance, will be incorporated into the final borders of Israel. The Palestinian refugee problem will be resolved outside the borders of Israel. It's therefore vital, absolutely vital, that a Palestinian state be fully demilitarized. And it's vital, absolutely vital, that Israel maintain a long-term military presence along the Jordan River. And as for Jerusalem, Jerusalem must never again be divided. Jerusalem must remain the united capital of Israel.
So, Leila, I couldn't help but laugh while I'm listening to this for the just a few times. It's just amazing, this whole charade. It's mind-boggling, the clapping, the standing ovations, and the misrepresentations and the lies. And I just wanted to get your reaction, basically, to what you just heard.
Well, Netanyahu, we need to separate the content from the form in this regard. I think that it took us all by big surprise, and I think it's even newspapers like the New York Times could not have, who are usually very pro-Israel, have noted how much it was a bit of a charade. Everybody's very eager to show that they are pro-Israeli, and really in the speech there was an element of PR, very strong element of PR, where every congressman did not want to be in any way and not seen to be supportive of Israel's prime minister. Whether they believe in everything that he said, whether they are interested in everything he said, is another thing. So the charade, the facade, the show-off, I think both the Israeli prime minister as much as people in Congress were aware that they were playing this game. So it's definitely an important sign of support. I don't want to undermine this in any way. But I think it shows as well how people are just a little bit too eager to show that they are so much pro-Israel, that in the end it doesn't say much in concrete terms, in terms of what's going to happen to the peace process, which is really the core issue here. Now, in terms of the content of Netanyahu's speech, I think it was very disappointing at more than one level, especially also with regards to Israelis, let alone Palestinian or the international community. But it's also revealing of how much Israel under Netanyahu is not really interested in a peace process or in a solution. I think the speech is insulting towards the Palestinian. I think, as you said, the speech has a number of lies insofar as how the prime minister is trying to portray the conflict. Like, for example, he didn't have the clip in which he says, why didn't we not achieve a Palestinian state so far, and why we don't have peace? And he said something very important in his speech. He said, since the Oslo process, there were six prime ministers who have been supportive of a Palestinian state, which is not totally right, but we'll take him on his word. I mean, I assume Rabin tacitly accepted a state. You have Barak, and you have Netanyahu came around to accept the idea of a Palestinian state. But when he came to say why we didn't have peace, it's because the Palestinians did not accept a Jewish state. So he's throwing basically back the ball in the Palestinian camp, and he did not mention that the reason why we don't have a Palestinian state and why we don't have peace is because of Israel's encroachment on Palestinian land, Israel's settlement policy, Israel's confiscation of more and more of Jerusalem, and the continuous imprisonment of the Palestinian through the checkpoint policy and through the apartheid wall. All that did not get mentioned, and as I said, these five things, the settlements, the wall, the loss of Jerusalem, also negating of the issue of refugee, is at the core of the failure of the peace process. So that's one element. The second element is, I found it interesting and important, because he basically laid out what is the Israeli position on a peace process. And as I always say, if we think of the conflict in easy term, the conflict really has five pillars. I've always said, you know, the solution to the conflict depends on addressing the five pillars of the conflict. And the five pillars of the conflict have always been, and also actually mentioned them, is land, you know, settlements, Jerusalem, refugees, and the future cooperation between the two sides. And on each of these elements, he basically stated a very clear Israeli annexation model, I would argue. Because on the issue of settlements, he basically said, yeah, we are not going to retreat from all settlements.
Well, and he refers to them as neighborhoods and suburbs. He didn't...
Exactly. He didn't call them settlements. I mean, in one part of the speech, he says, yeah, let's face it, we have to be honest, not all the settlements will be dismantled.
Yeah, you know? That was the only incident.
Yeah, that's the only thing. But basically, with the other alarming thing, which I found very interesting, is when he said that the 650,000 Israelis living in the suburb, look how very important connotation he says, he living in the suburbs of Tel Aviv
and
Jerusalem, which are basically all the settlements in the West Bank, either along the Green Line or around Jerusalem.
Yeah.
These will be part of Israel, which means if you annex those, we're going back to the Barak plan, you're talking about an annexation of 10% of the West Bank, which in itself might not sound too much, but de facto cuts the West Bank into three major population areas which are disconnected, and thus you don't have a contiguous Palestinian state. So on the second point, which is the element of the land, the Palestinians are not going to have sovereignty over the 22% of the West Bank. They're going to have segmented areas, which I often call Bantustans, because a population locked around checkpoints who cannot exit outside or inside without an Israeli permit, like the pass system in South Africa, and who don't have whose economic viability and dependence relies on access to Israeli labor market or Israeli good markets. So that's the second point. The third point is his very clear and astonishing point, I think, which comes in retaliation to Obama, is the issue of the borders.
Yes.
He clearly said that Jordan Valley would be under Israeli control because it needs that. And also said that the 1967 border is not the starting point of the negotiation because it makes Israel vulnerable. This is in clear contradiction or opposition, let's say, to Obama's speech a day later when he said the 1967 border is the starting point of the negotiation with acceptable land swaps. I mean, I know they're talking about the same thing, basically, but each one is emphasizing something different. And I think because each one is trying to address a different public, Netanyahu is trying to address his government coalition who are on the right and who said the 1967 border is not the starting point. And also Netanyahu believes that. Obama was trying to appeal to the Palestinian side and the international law by saying the 1967 border is the starting border, the starting point of the negotiation. And the other thing is that he insists on having a demilitarized Palestinian state.
Yes.
In that respect, it is similar to Obama. Obama did say the state, we need to sort out some security arrangement, but the state will be a demilitarized state.
Did Obama actually say demilitarize?
I think he did say demilitarize, but what he did not mention the Jordan Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And it's understood that, I mean, he said about we need to work out certain security arrangements mm-hmm. that meet Israeli security, but also meet Palestinian sovereignty.
Yes.
So he left it more vague.
But technically that's what it means.
But I mean, I think also the Palestinians are aware that their state will be demilitarized. What the Palestinians have been insisting on, the Palestinian Authority, is that they will have control over the Jordan Valley.
Mm-hmm.
They do not want Israeli presence. And over the past 20 years, whenever the issue of the Jordan Valley was brought up, the negotiation went towards either to have an international observer along it or to have, but in any case, it will not be militarized.
Yeah.
But the idea is a sovereignty. Palestinians want the sovereignty. Israel basically what is offering is a Bantustan, which it wants to declare a state. Because, again, the Palestinian state will not be contiguous. The Palestinian state will not have access to outside borders or to Israel. It will be all within the confines of Israel. There is no mention of the wall or any mention, as I said, the majority of settlements will be integrated into Israel. And on Jerusalem, that's a very important point. Mm-hmm. By Netanyahu, basically, he said it's not going to be divided. And in this respect, he's going against the Clinton plan
mm-hmm.
And even what we'd call the, the late Prime Minister Olmert plan. Mm-hmm. Olmert suggested that he could adopt the Clinton plan, which said everything which is Arab will be under Arab control and everything which is Jewish in Jerusalem will be under Jewish control, which is a different way of rephrasing UN Resolution 242, basically accepting that East Jerusalem is Palestinian,
mm-hmm.
but how we're going to demarcate the boundary is left still vague, but at least acknowledge Palestinian control and sovereignty over the Palestinian populated area of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Of East Jerusalem, we're talking. So that was an important point on Netanyahu, because basically when you're saying that Jerusalem is going to be always an eternal part of Israel and never divided, you're basically cutting the north of the West Bank from the south of the West Bank, not to mention that you're incorporating Ma'ali Adumim,
mm-hmm.
which is a very big settlement that de facto, again, further fragments and Bantustanizes the Palestinian state.
And the context of when he mentioned Jerusalem, his preamble to this was talking about religious freedoms and how only under Israel's sovereignty were Christians, Jews, and Muslims able to have religious freedom, which I found an incredible distortion of facts. Maybe you want to address that, Leila.
Yeah, that's a big distortion of fact. It's inaccurate historically. Jerusalem was an open city and prospered, particularly under the Ottoman mm-hmm. Empire. Under British rule, there were lots of contention because of Zionism in the 1920s, but before the 1914, Jerusalem was actually, whoever managed Jerusalem had protected the free religion in a very respectful way. I mean, Jerusalem was always a place of contention because everybody wanted a piece of Jerusalem. I mean, if we look at the Christian quarters, how the different churches fought over various pieces of mm-hmm. The city, but the management of the city, the manager of the city under the Ottoman, did a very good job in protecting all three religion and respecting them. So he's not accurate about that. But it's a way of explaining and justifying why Israel is important, and in that he is very eager always to use whatever suits his argument. Like, mm-hmm. I found also another funny thing from what you're saying. I mean, is when he started his speech by saying that Israel is the bastion, is the anchor of stability now in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And I laugh because the saying has always been, Israel has always tried to promote itself as the only democracy in the region. And now that Arab countries are becoming democratic, the new slogan is, Israel is the anchor of stability in the region because the Middle East is not stable.
Yes.
So, you know, this is a tactical way by which you want to justify slogans to distort, you know, to justify Israel's existence and its importance, why the U.S. should support Israel.
Mm-hmm.
On the refugees, I'm actually not very surprised on the refugee stand. I find the fact that he would say that whoever believes in a two-state solution ultimately will accept that, will have to accept two sooner or later that the refugees will have to go in a Palestinian state, not in a Jewish state.
Before we talk about refugees, let's talk about the UN and the way this impasse, this conflict has been addressed. So we start with the UN resolution, which is illegal technically to partition Palestine, but the world accepted it, and Netanyahu basically applauds this partition and accepts the UN mandate. And however, then, you know, in the same breath, he goes to UN Resolution 242, which calls for the ending of the occupation, and he adamantly rejects it. And in this, you know, so is the UN, does the UN have mandate or it doesn't? And then we have the quartet, we have the US. This for somebody who's not really following the US-Israeli situation closely, it's very confusing to people to know who's deciding or not, and what are the, you know, what are the rights and rules and laws that we have to abide by when we're determining this this conflict. So maybe a little bit of commentary on how vague, you know, this whole process is to start with.
Well, let's you know, I mean, we cannot do now a short history of the conflict in the
not a history, no, but
I think your question is a very important question, which is the role of the UN in all this. I think the role of the UN is of two types. It has the UN plays two roles. The first role, that it provides a legal context, an international legal context for resolving this conflict, or how the international community considers the optimal solution to the conflict. And the second one is that it has some legal tools that we can use and not use. The UN has always, ever since its existence, came in after the Second World War to help mediate conflicts so long as the parties, the different states, accept its mediation, right? And also provides, through its resolution, a legal context that you can use either in the international court system or whenever the parties also choose to use it. In other words, as an objective third party stand that can be useful in resolving conflicts. So with regards to the Arab-Israeli conflict, it played these both roles. First, it provided the verdict, the international verdict, how the international community, how the world of states tried to help resolving this conflict when Arabs and Israelis could not resolve it, or when the British mandate at the time could no longer resolve it, and had it in the file, the Palestinian file, the Palestine file, to the UN in 1947. And this is how the UN came with the partition plan, which is UN Resolution 181. It's important, this UN Partition Plan 181, because it's a General Assembly resolution. In other words, the countries of the world in 1947 thought that partition is the best available solution. It doesn't say, so in that respect, we cannot say that it's not legal. It is legal. It was not accepted by the Palestinians at the time. It doesn't have the power of imposition. That's true, it cannot be enforced unless the parties want to enforce it.
Exactly.
But it provides an important verdict, an opinion, if you want, approved by everybody, by the international community at the time. Now, the other important resolution is UN Resolution 242, because this UN Resolution 242 is voted by the Security Council,
exactly,
which, in contrast to the General Assembly, it provides it's forcible and also provides the opinion of the superpowers, which you would argue is more important than or opinion of the average states, if you want. And in that UN Resolution 242, the position was that we de facto, implicitly, it said, we accept the boundaries of 1967 wars, in other words, which goes against UN Partition Plan of 181. It does not mention specifically a two-state solution, unlike the Partition Plan 181. But it does say specifically the occupation is illegal and Israel has to retreat from the land it occupied in 1967.
To the 67 borders.
To the 67 borders. And the lines are before June 4th, 1967. And it's important because basically it set the stage, it defined what are the terms of any peaceful negotiation in the Middle East. And it said clearly that the way that Israel has to retreat from land it occupied in exchange for recognition and peace from its neighbor. This is why it became known as the Land for Peace formula. Israel retreats, the Arabs give it recognition. And that's what has provided the base for negotiation with Egypt and the peace treaty with Egypt, as well as with Jordan. With the Palestinian, it was a more stumbling block because UN Resolution 242 did not mention them. It only mentioned them as refugees. It did not mention them as a national group.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that over the past 40 years, with Oslo in particular, the past 30 years between 1967 until 1993, what Oslo brought about when the Palestinian and Israeli sat together brought about one very important fact, basically that the Israeli recognized for the first time ever that there is a Palestinian people as a national group. These people who are living in the West Bank and Gaza are not just simply Arabs whose future is to be resolved with Jordan. With also Israel officially recognized that there is something called the Palestinian as a national group with having a right to national representation and that the PLO is their representative.
Mm-hmm.
And the also agreement was all about defining how the Palestinians and the Israeli are going to divide this land. The problem with also is that Israel interpreted it that the future negotiation is going to be over the West Bank,
mm-hmm.
whereas for the and Gaza, whereas for the Palestinian, the negotiation was about how Israel is going to retreat fully, and we're going to have a viable one Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, and we accept Israel in the 1967 borders.
Mm-hmm.
So how can the UN help? The UN can help by telling you, UN Resolution 242 is the baseline of our negotiation. This is why Obama reiterated it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, by saying that the 67 border is the base of all negotiation. That's important because you're basically saying the settlements, you implicitly say by this that the settlements are illegal.
Yes.
Yeah, this is why it's important. Now, there are other venues in which you can use the UN, like when the Palestinians presented the case against the apartheid wall, against the wall that Israel was building, because it was not on the 1967 border. And the International Court of Justice ruled in favor of the Palestinians and ordered Israel to redraw the wall along the 1967 border and not inside and into Palestinian land in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. So we see two opportunities in which the UN can provide a legal mechanism and can provide also an international consensus on how to solve the problem. What the UN cannot provide is how you're going to enforce the resolution,
mm-hmm.
because enforcing the resolution hangs on the superpowers. And in this respect, the superpowers have avoided wanting to enforce Israel to abide by international law for multiple reasons we can get into if we have time.
Mm-hmm.
But in that respect, this is why also the speech of Netanyahu becomes very important, because he's basically coming to the superpower of today, which is the U.S., the only entity that can force Israel to retreat or not to retreat. We saw this U.S. effectively in 1992 actually used its power, the power of aid, when Israel did not want to go to the negotiations in Madrid, when the peace negotiations started between the Palestinians and the Israeli within the multilateral negotiations. Basically, the Bush administration at the time, which is Bush Senior, said if Israel will not give aid to Israel, so long as Israel is using this aid for building the settlements. So there we saw an effective... not insignificant, it's not very important. And they use just the aid, which is $3.5 billion. The U.S. basically said, we're not going to give this money for building settlements, which are against international law, and also compromise the peace process. Yeah. And the effect of this withdrawal was that the Likud government at the time fell, and the Rabin government, the Labor government, came to power, and within 9 months, it's actually signed the peace deal. Signed the Oslo agreement with the Palestinians. So today, the U.S. doesn't want to use this. The U.S. doesn't want to impose anything on Israel. And by Netanyahu coming to speak to Congress, we see how Netanyahu is trying to get support within the U.S. Elected officials to support Israel and not to get it to impose on it anything it does not wish to have.
Mm-hmm. So going back to this idea of a two-state solution and the nature of the Palestinian state, Netanyahu emphasized more than once in his speech a demilitarized Palestinian state, meaning a state with no rights, because rights are only meaningful if you have a way to actually enforce them. And So the Palestinian Authority has been in the past few months moving towards a declaration of a Palestinian state, where... the state, you know, can have legitimacy in the international community if people recognize it, but it does not have the power to enforce rights and to enforce it to basically create a decent and
viable state.
Viable state for the Palestinians. And so if it will collapse inevitably, basically, because it has no it doesn't have any way of enforcing itself there. And the way I see this is that the Palestinian Authority is actually doing the work for Israel. You know, it's by going along and declaring a Palestinian state under the current conditions, they've actually accepted this de facto Bantustan situation. And
it's a little bit more complicated. I mean,
give me your opinion.
I think that the going ahead to declare the state.
It's basically accepting the status of a Palestinian state with no sovereignty.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, I think. I think on the point of the demilitarized state, I have to say, I'm not too sure that a demilitarized state is not a sovereign state, because I think you can find different security arrangements that can maintain the viability of the state. I think the core issue for the Palestinian is having outside borders, and the Palestinian state will always have a police. The point is not to have it have a large army so that it will not invade Israel. That's the argument. And I don't think it's going to harm it too much not to have a big army. I mean, at least it will save us money being wasted on the
yeah, but without that an army, a state will be under the power of, it does not really have sovereignty. Borders can always be, you know.
Well, that's what where you can have different security arrangements, like you had in Bosnia, for example, like you had in Nepal, where you have various countries in Kosovo, where you can have a military which is just symbolic, and you have an international community that can guarantee invasion and no attack on neighbors. I think the core issue is more the fact of what you mentioned, that the land is not contiguous, and Israel's presence, even the problem with Israel is not that it's just present at the borders. It's present everywhere in the West Bank and Gaza, because Jerusalem is in the heart of the West Bank and Gaza. Yeah. So anytime you want to go from Ramallah to Hebron or Bethlehem, you're going to pass through Israeli areas. Mm-hmm. Every time you want to trade with Israel, because 90% of your exports and 70% of your imports are coming from Israel, you still need to. So the problem is not the military as much as the territory is not contiguous and is not allowed to be contiguous because of the settlements, because of the bypass roads, because Israel is controlling, we see it also in Gaza, control the air, the sea, and the boundaries. So I think that's the stumbling block. Now, why are the Palestinians still going ahead and want the United Nations to give them their admission of a Palestinian state? I think for two reasons. One, if you go to the West Bank, the Palestinians have suffered so much from Israel, they don't want to be with Israelis, they don't want to see Israelis, they just want to live their life, run their own affairs. The PA can be seen as sometimes as the tool of the occupiers, but also for some people it allowed them some empowerment and not having to deal with daily Israeli incursions as it happened in the 1970s or 1980s. So the Palestinian Authority now have autonomy. They can run the affair of the Palestinian people. The next step, and that always has been their dream in the essence of their participation in the Oslo Agreement, was to obtain a state, a viable state. And they've tried to obtain this viable state via negotiations for the past nearly 18 years, since 1993. And they got nowhere. So the Palestinian leadership who have, you know, campaigned on the Palestinian state, who have prepared the Palestinian public for a Palestinian state, every Palestinian most Palestinians in 1993 or 1995 wanted to give this two-state solution a real leap of faith and believe in it, you know? And the leadership, be it Arafat as well as Abu Mazen, as well as all this, Al-Saib Arakat, all this generation of people who fought before in Lebanon or who fought in the First Intifada and who've dreamt of an independence, want to see it happen. And they tried in all their ways, through every means, to be as accommodating to Israel as possible, to be as accommodating with the American as possible, and they still did not get anything. So I think for them it's the last straw. You understand? It's the last, okay, we did everything we could, okay? And the last step is the peace process failed not because of us, as has always been accused by Israelis. They always said the peace process, or it's not possible with the Palestinian to negotiate with the Palestinian because they never lose an opportunity to negotiate. This time they proved they tried everything. They are not the bad guys or the sabotagers of the peace process. Rather, it's Israel. Mm-hmm. And they want to put it back in the UN camp to provide us, again, like UN Resolution 181, to provide an international verdict on whether or not we're going to have a Palestinian state. And mm-hmm. I think if they would go for the vote, in principle, every superpower, the quartet, Bush, Obama, all of them said that now the only solution to the conflict is the creation of a Palestinian state, which mm-hmm. is quite phenomenal in historical terms, because 20 years ago, nobody would have said that. Today is an incredible success that in a UN resolution like UN Resolution 242 that does not mention the Palestinian, it's 40 years down the road, they finally tell you that the only solution to the conflict is not simply a retreat of Israel from land it occupied, but actually the creation of a viable Palestinian state. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, it's going to be a very important symbolic gesture. It will provide also another legal tool that you could use, because if the UN declares a Palestinian state, now Israel is not occupying contested land as it claims. It's occupying another state. Mm-hmm. So legally, it opens a whole new venues for legal action against Israel, apart from also embarrassing Israel. Symbolically, it's also going to be very important. The core issue, as you said, how far will this legal verdict or this symbolic verdict be implemented on the ground, given the reality of Bantustanization?
And given the reality of, 60 years of dealing with the UN and its lack of, and the international community. So what's another UN resolution?
Maybe for the leadership to provide the closure, you know? We close it, we have another resolution, like UN Resolution 181, mm-hmm. and we wait for another day. But maybe it will be finally the thing that will, the nail that will bury the coffin of the two-state solution once and for all, because... Mm-hmm. You know, you got the verdict, but like UN Resolution 181, UN Resolution 181 says that Israel should be created on 56% of historic Palestine, mm-hmm. not 78% of historic Palestine. Do you understand? I mean, I think it's more of a symbolic, and I think also it's a way maybe by the PA to say, look, the American and the Israelis are too powerful. Yeah. They voted it down, and, because they're passing through the UN, they're not passing through the UN General Assembly, not the U.S. Security Council. So
the U.N., not
yeah,
U.S.
Exactly.
The UN, it's de facto U.S. Security Council, but yeah.
So I think it's a symbolic gesture and also a legal gesture, which can provide some venue. But as you said, this is not going to resolve it neither here nor there on the ground, because I think so long as Israel does not see that the creation of a viable Palestinian state is in its interest, it would not do it. And I think now that Israel is seeing a changing Middle East, mm-hmm. with all the popular democratic revolts that have been taking place, mm-hmm. is probably counting that these revolts are going to bring more instability than stability, because we've seen so far only two successes in Tunisia and Egypt. All other countries in which people went out to the street demanding for democracy, they were either crushed, like in Bahrain or Syria, or risked to go into a civil war, as in Libya or maybe mm-hmm. now Yemen. Israel thrives on instability in the region. But if the revolution succeeds, and I think ultimately they will succeed, it's going to have many serious repercussions on Israel. But there's one thing I want to say, Obama's speech brought up, and I think also Israel should really... government at least would be concerned with. Obama talked about the right to self-determination of the people, of mm-hmm. the individuals. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a very, very important notion, yes. because it is true. What happened in the Middle East, people have said, we got our independence. It's not about our independence. It's not about the West. It's about our rights, about citizen rights. Mm-hmm. And when the Arab street and Arab countries start talking about citizen rights, finally we'll be able to shift away from a Palestinian state or a Jewish state or mm-hmm. a Syrian state, when we start to talk about a state of rights and a state for all its citizens. Yeah. And maybe once we start talking about that, that is very alarming for somebody who cares about a Jewish state. Mm-hmm. And this is why I think now there's so much insistence on Israel that everybody has to accept it as a Jewish state.
In other words, an apartheid state where, where basically your social and economic rights are attached to your identity and your religion.
Your ethnicity, exactly. That's the real core issue now. But I feel ultimately, so far, given how weak the Arab state is, I mean, the Arab governments are, given how, I mean, how the Palestinians do not have the military muscle to threaten Israel or attack Israel, and so long as the Palestinians are divided, it's going to be very difficult to challenge Israel.
So we have about 5 minutes, and I want to focus a little bit about what's happening in the between Palestinian Authority, the Fatah, basically, and Hamas.
Yes.
So we had on March 15, we had some unity protests in the West Bank, and they've been some kind of a generational shift. A lot of young people going to the street calling for the PNC, the Palestinian, it's basically the
National Congress.
Council. It's calling for elections and calling for unity. What's your sense of what's going on now between Fatah and Hamas? Do you think we will ever get to a point where our leadership has the vision to drop this whole two-state solution and focus more on a pluralistic state that has encompassing all of Palestine with equal rights for everyone and ending this impasse that will never be resolved with, 10 more UN resolutions, basically, because they're not dealing with the core source of the problems.
Well, I mean, they are trying to deal with the core source, but what we're faced with today, the challenging problem for the one-state solution is how you're going to counter the argument for citizens' rights with the argument for national rights.
Mm-hmm.
Palestinians have to address the issue of Jewish identity and Israeli identity and culture that has been created over the past 60 years. And the Israeli need to address the reality of the Palestinian and Arab culture, which it has tried to negate and say that it is itself a Western state that has nothing to do with the Muslims and Arabs around it. So I think the national challenge is still what's keeping the two-state solution alive. And so long as we don't, this is not going to shift, we're not going to get any closer. But coming back to your question on the relationship between Hamas and Fatah, I think the reconciliation is a very important step and inevitable, because they realize that also the Arab street, the Palestinian street, that is demanding unity and is demanding a new vision.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the Hamas and Fatah can have a new vision for the time being, with this leadership, I doubt, because mm-hmm. it's a leadership that is invested in the national argument and nationalist ideology for a separate state that protects Arab culture, protects Islamic identity, protects Palestinianhood. Will we see a change in the near future? I suspect so, because a new generation is going to come up, and the new generation is calling on its representative to be accountable, to protect citizens' rights, to be a state of rights and representation. Will this new leadership and new generation want unity with Israelis? I don't know if this is going to happen very soon, but there are definitely people working on it, and it's important to happen. But in that respect, it's also important for the borders to come down and people to meet each other.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, those who advocate the one-state solution are often people who are outside Palestine or inside 48, because the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza have only seen Israelis as soldiers, have not seen them as human being.
Mm-hmm.
And Israeli on the other side with the wall have never anymore seen Palestinians. The only way they see Palestinians is through them, their press and their TV, which portrays them either as terrorists or as poor, brutal people. So I think there's so much work to do in terms of exposing the truth on both sides, but this can only happen once people feel secure in their identity and in their rights. So I think the core point and the prospect for a one-state solution starts with people campaigning for rights and accountability,
mm-hmm.
and that's happening finally, and it's becoming louder, and we have to wait now for the new generation to take over the lead.
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be, and is happening, coordination between Palestinians inside Israel, Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and Palestinians in the diaspora and the refugee camps,
mm-hmm.
whose voices have not been heard, but
yeah.
they are there, and they're present, and they are part of the Palestinian constituents like everybody else.
Yes, actually, they represent almost 70% of Palestinian population, and the peace process and the two-state solution does not really address their grievances.
Exactly. And maybe the two-state solution is finally dead, but, you know, death can take a long time. But the one-state solution is definitely the only option in town. When will it happen, that's going to depend on our activism and our knowledge.
Leila, we're just about ready to wrap up this program. Thank you so much for being with us this morning and for valuable comments on the state of affairs today. Have a lovely day.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Leila. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. This is all the time we have for today's show. Thank you so much for your time. And that's it for us today. In the meantime, whisper, talk, or scream, but do not remain silent. Thank you for listening. Thank you, WZBC Truth and Justice Radio. My email address is salma.abuayash@gmail.com. Send me your comments and feedback or questions on how to find any of the news we shared with you today. Have a great day. Until next time, take good care of our world and of yourselves. تمتطي قوس قزح من